Hello and welcome to the program. Today we hear concerns coming from experts who say that bumblebees are literally starving to death. It's good news for nightjars. One of the world's most enigmatic bird species has been rediscovered here in Ireland. And never mind about the woman who swallowed a fly, I swallowed an insect.
I know an old lady who swallowed a fly. I don't know why she swallowed the fly. Perhaps she'll die. I know an old lady who swallowed a spider to twiggle, to jiggle, to twiggle inside her. She swallowed the spider to catch the fly, but I don't know why she swallowed the fly. Perhaps she'll die.
Believe it or not, that's our very own Aine Ní Lana singing "I Know an Old Lady Who Swallowed a Fly." And Aine Ní Lana is with us here in studio, as is Richard Collins. Now, Aine, the reason we're playing that is because the other day I swallowed an insect. I couldn't believe it. This time of year, swallowing an insect. And I coughed and I splurted and everything else, and I nearly choked. Am I going to die?
I don't know why you swallowed the fly, Derek.
I don't know if it was a fly even.
But you might die, because a lot of insects are eaten by people as they eat their food, because a lot of plant food will have bits of insects in them, heads, wings, legs. In fact, there are regulations as to how much is allowed to be in certain types of food.
And like in your cereal and the like.
Like in your cereal, like in your spinach, like in any kind of processed food, grain, bread, things like this. So people, I would say, over the course of a year might eat up to a kilogram of bits of insects.
Not to mention the old kind of myth that we swallow tons of them at night when we're in bed asleep, spiders crawling into our mouth and in our nostrils and into our ears and all that kind of stuff. Do you believe any of that?
I mean, it's not a matter of belief. Either we do or we don't. So, I mean, do you keep your bedroom filthy? What are you doing at night, licking the walls? You know, this sort of thing. I don't believe that we swallow loads of spiders at night, quite frankly. No, I don't. But the thing about the insects and that eating them gives a lie, actually, to people who are vegan and don't want to be eating any kind of animal matter. Well, they are eating all of this carry-on when they're eating their food.
In defence of the vegans, Anna, the insects are actually dead and as doughnuts. I remember reading...
But nobody eats live anything.
Well, that's true, but their
steaks are dead when we eat them.
I know, but you don't kill for it, shall we say. You don't go killing the insects in order to eat them, whereas you kill the bullock in order to eat the steak. But I read somewhere that each of us consumes something like a kilo of insect parts every year. It reminds me of the tubes in London, all that dust. About half of that dust, I'm told, is dried particles of human skin.
Oh, lovely. Never mind, mind the gap, mind the dust.
Well, Derek, if you want to avoid eating a fly, keep your gob shut.
Thank you, Aine.
Mind the gap.
Now, bees are our most effective pollinators. They're vital to our survival on the planet. And there are few sounds as distinctive or as welcome as the sunny buzz of the bumblebee. But is that sound about to vanish imminently from our countryside and gardens? That is the concern coming from experts who say that the bumblebee is starving to death. About a third of Ireland's bumblebee species are critically endangered, and their loss would trigger a wider emergency for food production and indeed for wildlife. In Ireland, we have 101 bee species, to the best of our knowledge. Most face the same plight as the bumblebee. Quite simply, if our bees disappear, many of our flowering plants, fruits and birds will disappear with them. Paul O'Brien is president of the Federation of Irish Beekeepers, and he joins us now from our studio in Galway. Hello, Paul. It's very nice to talk to you. Let's begin by distinguishing the bumblebee from the honeybee, because you're very interested in honeybees, as we know from our time on the programme with the late Philip McCabe.
Well, as a beekeeper, we take a keen interest in all of our bees, our solitary bees, our bumblebees, and of course our honeybees. But there's a bigger problem too with all insects. So we actually need to care for all the insect environment.
Well, let's talk about the bumblebee first. What's going on there?
Well, the bumblebee, its habitat has been attacked, for want of a better word, and the climate isn't helping it either. We have beekeepers who keep records for the last 20 years of doing bumblebee counts. And the biggest decline we had this year was in Kilkenny. We had 42% decline of the bumblebee. Mm-hmm. And one of the biggest problems we have at the moment is the lack of forage and habitat for bees. We've gone as a society into these big monocultures of crops within the pasture lands, and we've left no escape routes or no edges of the fields for our insects and our bumblebees to get, A, food, and two, places to hide and nest.
So then, are you compounding the issue then as a beekeeper by turning up with beehives? I mean, honeybees are not in danger. And what you're actually doing then, bringing new hives into an area, is sending out more hungry mouths to be fed in an area that can't even keep the bumblebees going. I mean, can you actually say the two things can happen? Is it like saying we'll have loads of chickens so that we'll save the bird population?
Well, not necessarily. In Ireland, we've 3,500 beekeepers in my organisation, the Federation of Irish Beekeepers, and most of them are hobbyists, so they'd have one to five hives, which is not a great pressure on the environment. Where I come from, in the west of Ireland, there was no beekeepers in my area, and we've reintroduced bees, and they're native Irish bees we have. So by doing that, we are helping the flowers pollinate them, and there'll be more flowers in the following season, which means there's more diversity for the wildlife as well.
Paul, that idea that somehow the domestic bee is taking over and is eliminating the food that Ian has suggested there, it's an interesting one, but I'm throwing my mind back to my childhood. Back then in Limerick, lots of people kept bees. We kept bees in the back garden and out the country as well. It was very common for people to keep bees. So the question arises, are there more bee colonies, honeybee colonies now than there were back then? Has there been a massive takeover?
Oh, I would think the opposite has happened. If you went back into the mid-40s and 50s and 60s, most beekeepers kept 20 hives or even more. And now most beekeepers are hobbyists, so they keep five to, as I say, one, five and 10. And what we've noticed over the last few years is that the core membership of the Federation of Irish Beekeepers is around 1,500 to 2,000 members. And with a transient every year of about 1,000 new beginners joining up and coming in every year. And even if they don't keep bees, they come to our courses and they spend 6 weeks or six lectures, whichever, six one-hour lectures. And they learn all about the environment and the bees. And they go off and they tell all their friends and neighbours to look out at the window of the environment by learning what they've learned from beekeeping. So I wouldn't think that the number of beehives has increased dramatically. It was very low 8-9 years ago, and we are building it up year on year. Some of these bees are being kept in the suburbs of cities where there was none. And I can see it in areas where there are beekeepers taking up the sport or the hobby over the last 5-6 years, and they're telling their neighbours and their friends are growing trees and plants that are beneficial to all the insects. And they're bringing an awareness to the hedgerows and everything. So the benefit of the beekeepers in Ireland outweighs any risk that may be perceived there.
I'm glad you mentioned suburban areas, because I have a lot to do around the country with tidy towns committees. And one of the things that tidy towns people do, I mean, they do lots of very, very good things improving the environment in urban areas. But they quite often plant things that are not at all suitable for bees. I mean, if you think, for example, that a bumblebee comes out of hibernation, the queen, because everything else has died, and she has to eat enough, she has to find enough food. She makes a nest, a little nest to begin with, and she gets pollen to make the pollen food, and she lays the eggs, and she has to get some nectar to feed herself. She has to visit 8,000 flowers to get that done before she lays any eggs to have any babies at all. Now, if you come out in the beginning of the year, at this time of the year, and all you can find are blinking daffodils, what good is that? There's no nectar in the daffodils, there's no pollen in the daffodils, and we should be encouraging people who grow plants not to be growing ones that are useless for bees. You look at the hanging baskets in towns, and they're full of petunias and begonias and primulas and red flowers. Bees can't see red. Why are they not planting things like bidens and bacopas?
How do you know bees can't see red, Aina?
Because it's not that I know this, Aina ni Launa. This has actually been done by scientific experts who look at the bees' eyes. The bees' range of vision goes from ultraviolet down as far as the beginning of the orange spectrum and stops there. Ours starts at the violet and goes all the way down to red. We can see red. Bees, when bees look at red, it looks black to them. But they can see in the ultraviolet spectrum, mm-hmm. so that when they look at the flowers, if you see swanky pictures on the web and things taken through ultraviolet lenses, and the middle of flowers are lit up like Dublin Airport, like runways. But in the wild, the only red flower really is the poppy, and the inside of that has all these ultraviolet lines going into it, and it's an open flower. But a big red rose, like everybody's running around with for Valentine's Day, all closed up like a big cabbage, that's useless for bees. So we should encourage people who are bringing then, so the tidy towns people might decide, oh, wouldn't it be nice to have a few honey beehives as well, in an area where there isn't enough food for the bumblebees at all because they've been planting the wrong things. So, like, it's not just as easy as Paul says, you know, there's... they will help. They'll only help if the countryside is fit to sustain them. I mean, there's a big campaign to encourage people to leave their dandelions when they come up in spring rather than considering them as weeds, because dandelions are full of nectar and they're full of pollen.
You'd prefer dandelions to daffodils, wouldn't you?
Well, yes, I would. They're lovely. I remember when my son, who is now 35, and killed me for mentioning this, when he was two, he brought me in a lovely bunch of dandelions to put in the vase because he thought they were lovely and yellow. And his big sister, who was five, said, they're only weeds. How could you bring them into Mammy? So, of course, they had to be put in the swankiest vase on the table because he had the right idea. Lovely yellow flowers, and he wasn't even a bee. So you can imagine how important it is to have these things. It's all brainwashing. Why should we hate dandelions and love daffodils? And if you were a bee, you certainly wouldn't.
Paul?
No, Ian is correct on the planting. The planting has not very beneficial to the bees and the bumblebees. At the moment, we do give lectures to the tidy towns and we do tell them, as Ian has said, to leave the dandelions and leave the flowers that are suitable for bees. And at this time of year, furze bushes are out, and furze bushes are the first pollen that we see coming into the hives. And again, we've tidied up our gardens too much. You know, let's let them go a little bit wild and let's set aside a quarter of your lawn to bees and to insects as well.
I'm reminded of a phrase of Tommy Hayden's, where he said, specialists go to the wall while the generalists inherit the earth. Now, my impression of the bee world is that the honeybee is the great generalist. He can turn his attention to anything. You'll get ivy, you'll get heather he'll exploit this, he'll exploit all kinds of plants and things. He can turn his hand
to... is the female.
I'm well aware of that, Ina. She is the female. Now, give me a chance, will you? Now, the other thing, if you take the bumblebees, it seems to me that they are specialists. They have contracted with individual flowers. There's 20 of them out there, and the flowers have negotiated, I'm going to concentrate on you because I want you to go to my kind of flower so that my pollen gets to the right flower and doesn't get wasted on flowers that are no use to me, you see. So you get this kind of specialisation in bumblebees. I presume that that is the model. So when the pressure comes on then, the specialists are more critical. They need a particular small range of plants, whereas something like the honeybees can change their tune and go off with something else. Is this model reasonable, Paul? Is there any basis for that?
No, what you say is 100% correct. But I'll go back to Ian and say, look, as beekeepers, we are the keepers in the sense of the bees, and we look at the environment around us, and we are promoting the environment. And we always tell our beekeepers not to flood an area. We suggest that no more than three hives for a 5-acre location. That way we're not putting pressure on the environment, as Ian is trying to allay. But we're also the spokespersons up and down the country telling children in schools and people we meet at market stalls that we have to protect our environment. And our biggest campaign for the last 3 years has been to protect the hedgerows. Mm. Because for some unknown reason, we've got this in our head in Ireland lately, to remove the hedgerows. Now, England and all over Europe, they're building insect highways up and down the country to put back in these hedgerows. And one thing we should all do as a society is to leave insect nature reserves. These may be 10 acres or smaller, and leave these highways leading up and down the country. We have to share the whole planet with all the insects and all the humans, but we have to plan this. It's not whether the honeybee is the king or the queen, for to be correct about it, but not that one species is more popular than another. We have to share the planet and we have to make a space for everybody.
Well, no, but back to Richard's point, if you're going to plan ahead and make sure that we share the planet for all the species that inhabit the planet, then you can take out the plants that the bumblebee needs if it is a specialist, and you can make sure that more of those species are planted. Am I not correct in saying that?
Oh, you're spot on correct in saying that. We need to plant those as well. But if we have no hedgerows and we have 50 acres of just green pasture grass, where are you going to grow this? We have to plant it. And the idea all over Europe is a 2-metre wide corridor at no more than 5 kilometres apart leading to these sanctuaries all over the country. And we have it. We already have it in the country. We don't have to do it. It's called hedgerows. Stop removing them. That's our campaign for the last 2 years, is to leave them. You know, if we don't have insects and bees and bumblebees, we don't have birds, the whole lot would collapse.
The point that Richard's making is that the bumblebees go to specific flowers, and if those specific flowers aren't there, the bumblebees won't survive. Is that actually true? I mean, can bumblebees not be able to go to the ordinary flowers that they've always gone to? I mean, are there special flowers on the Bullen Peninsula that aren't anywhere else? Or what are they feeding there? I mean, has there been any research done on the actual requirements of the bumblebees?
There has been, but I think the bigger, while there's a lack of diversity of plants, if I was to say to you that the only thing you can get is a limited amount of food and you'd only eat all your meals from McDonald's for the rest of your life or something like that, you wouldn't be thriving very well. You'd be craving other pollens and other nectars. Mm-hmm. Our diversity is gone. And we have to make national and global decisions how we tackle this. It has to be planned out. And it's not, we keep thinking in the short term of 1 year, 3 years. We have to be planning for the next 100 years.
But there is a pollinator plan, which has been going on since 2015, if I'm not mistaken.
It has been excellent. It has been excellent. It has brought awareness. Well, like, we wouldn't be talking about this 20 years ago. We're talking about it now because they've done a fantastic job of bringing it to the public awareness.
They have, but in fairness, Paul, we have been talking about it for 20 years.
With one
of your former colleagues, Philip McCabe, the late Philip.
A very close friend.
As you know, indeed, of course. Yeah. So we were always talking about it on this programme. Andy, you might just talk about that National Pollinator Plan, just to remind people what it is.
Yeah, the National Pollinator Plan. It's an all-Ireland pollinator plan, and the first phase of it is 2015 to 2020, as you have said. And what they have done is they've gone through all the different habitats. I was just at a meeting last night in Newbridge where they were handing them out again, and there's a document for farmland, there's a document for gardens, there's a document for hedgerows, there's a document for each of these things, there's documents for local communities, what they can all do. And in fact, the thing I'm holding in my hand here is pollinator friendly plants for your garden. Now, these are not necessarily native wildflowers that people call weeds. These are actually things you can buy in the shop if you want to. Lovely herbs like rosemary and borage you can plant in springtime. Things like scabious and verbena you can put in the summer. And then there's a range of them in the autumn as well, heathers and salvias. And in winter, then you have your hellebores and your viburnums and your mahonias and willow. Willow is great. So this is what the pollinator plan is encouraging people to do, because bees are the only creatures that want pollen. Pollen is collected by bees to feed their young with, and they collect nectar then to feed the grown-ups with. In the case of honeybees, they make the nectar into honey. In the case of bumblebees and solid, they just collect the nectar for them to eat as nectar. Other insects will go for the nectar, like things like butterflies and that, and the pollen is kind of a nuisance to them. It just gets stuck on their head. But the bees actually collect the pollen, so they're focused on going to plants with lots of pollen on them. That's why things like willow are full of pollen, though they don't necessarily go on to have flowers or petals on them. They've catkins with loads of pollen on them, which are very valuable for bees this time of the year, early in the year when the pollen is there.
Yeah, the decline of the insects globally is around 3.7% per annum. But in Ireland, we're 1% above that average.
Why is that?
I would say that it's because of our increase in our dairy industry. In every single field that we have tillage or grassland, we're probably using about herbicides about 15 times per annum on the same piece of field. So we're wiping them out.
50% of Ireland's land, 50% is covered in grass. Grassland for farming, 50%. Now, the other 50 isn't. And the farmers who grow grass to feed their animals really want grass. They don't want buttercups and they don't want other bloody things taking up space when it could be 100% grass. And this is what the farming work is. So the herbicides are used to get rid of non-grass flowers.
Well,
so
the farmers have to live too, you know.
Well, I'm not saying yay or nay to that. I'm just saying 50%. And Paul is right. So these fields of grass that fed animals, fed cows when I was young, me and Finn McCool, were actually hay meadows and there were flowers in them. And they weren't cut till July, so that the stuff that was on the ground, the bees, bumblebees nests, were left alone until July. Now they get a number one haircut in May for silage, and that any animals that might be living in the soil just at the bottom of those meadows are removed as well. So not only are there no flowers for them to actually feed on, but the little holes in the bottoms of the fields where the bumblebees will have their nests are being removed by that silage making. We think of silage as putting an end to the poor old corncrake, and it is, but it's also putting an end to the poor old bumblebees who nest at the bottom of the ground in the soil under the hayfields.
But we could tackle that by leaving strips of land at the edges and let them go into wild. Let
clover, we could, of course, yeah. I mean, it's not impossible. Let clover come back. Yeah. And farmers could have their cake and eat it. They could have their grass. If they didn't want to, bloody well take out every hedge for the extra strip of whatever it is that they get. If they left a border, a headland and under hedge, they'd have, you know, it wouldn't take up that much.
But I wouldn't expect the farmer to be out of pocket either. I think as a society, we should pay for that and say, fine, Mr. Farmer, Mrs. Farmer, we'll give you a grant to keep 2 metres at the edge into wildlife, and we should pay them. And
yeah, but I mean, we have the GLAS schemes, but that tends to be not the really intensive farmers. It tends to be the extensive ones, which is at least good at any rate.
A few things, Paul. We're mentioning how they don't see red. Yes, some of the bumblebees have red on their plumages. Presumably the bees see a red-tailed bumblebee in a different kind of way, and they are able to detect the redness indirectly. The other thing I wanted to bring up was the extraordinary intelligence. There was some research in Queen Mary College a few years ago showing that bumblebees are able to work and solve problems with little balls that they would push to the centre of a sphere, and the ball would then tumble in and they would get a reward. And when this was tried on bumblebees, they were extremely astute at knowing which ball was nearest to the hole and things like that, and the colours of balls, and some were better than others. These are a very adaptive and capable kind of set of animals. There should be hope for them. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. They've been here well before we came onto planet Earth, and I've a funny feeling they'll be here well after we're all gone. They are well able to adapt. And just going back to the colours, for your listeners, if they ever get a chance and look at the web, you'll find a thing called nectar glides. And as Aina was, it's like Dublin Airport, all the plants have their own nectar glides, and they're in ultraviolet spectrum. And when the bee flies along, they'll be lit up and they look like, bring them right down to where the nectar is. And another thing, that flowers talk to the insects, and you say, how do they do that in this day and age? If you take a glass at home and fill it full of water and hit it with the spoon, it's a different resonance. And when you empty out the glass, it's got a higher frequency of resonance. And the bees are listening to the flowers and they're being vibrated from the wind. And they know not to waste their time going down to an empty glass.
That's how they know the nectar's gone by the previous bee has taken it.
So you talk about the intelligence. You can see that intelligence yourself. And kids often ask me this question, when a bee lands in a bunch of marigolds, they go, why do they go for one and not the other? Because they can hear it and they can see it.
No one has nothing in it.
And it's been suggested that individual plants put out electric fields, which the bees detect. Mm. They have their own, shall we say, frequency of electrical transmission.
Well, there is, and they use polarised light.
Thing.
They use polarised light and they use electric magnetic fields. And as well as that, the American intelligence people, we'll call it that, they started using bees to track down explosives. Like you say with the bumblebee, they were training bees to get rewards, and then they were asking them to find explosives, and they were excellent at doing this.
Paul, if these were falcons or hawks, they would go to the wall more quickly than the ones below them, the little songbirds and things on which hawks and falcons feed. Now, there are these cuckoo bees. Now, if there is a big problem, surely the cuckoo bees will go out of business before the others. How are our cuckoo bees doing?
They are surviving, but no more than the ordinary bees. They're under the exact same pressure. If there's not enough nests for them to lay their offspring in, then they will disappear too. I wouldn't identify one over the other. They're all in trouble, and it's a balance.
It seems to me, though, that it's the way we treat our environment in Ireland that's the greatest culprit, rather than saying, oh, it's climate change and we can do nothing about that. I mean, if we treated our environment properly, I know climate change is happening, but it's happening at a greater rate in other parts of the world. So we really can't sit back and say, well, what can we do? It's climate change. We can do lots and lots of things managing our environment in a proper way for bees. We can't get off the hook by just saying it's climate change.
Oh, I think we've speeded up the destruction of our environment in Ireland over the last 20 years.
Well, worldwide, January was the warmest January on record for 141 years, apparently.
Imagine that. I fully agree with Aina. We're doing it faster.
Because we were
way behind. We had non-intensive agriculture in the 60s. And then I think once we joined the EU and lately, since we increased the dairy, we're full on with our intensive agriculture.
At least we got rid. We got rid of the neonicotinoids, those poisons that were actually affecting not only the plants, but also the nectar and the pollen. They used those in America to spray their almond trees. So all these people who are now drinking almond milk instead of cow's milk are actually encouraging the growth of almond trees being sprayed and the death of loads of bees that are brought over to California to pollinate those. But that's another story.
Paul, you wanted this. Paul was saying well when you said that. Go on, Paul, yeah.
Well, if you go back to the original, Annie, you were saying if we put too many beehives in an area, we kill the other insects around us. That's the same way. If we keep going with one food product, almond milk is the new hoo-ha, avocados next, there'll be something else, and, you know, coconut palm trees were being destroying other places. I don't know what's wrong with it. We seem to crave something new in our diet or something new in our shop fronts without thinking long term about the consequences. Air miles, food miles, all this stuff, we're not thinking. And I have to say, it's wonderful what Greta Thunberg has done in a sense. She's brought this awareness into the younger generations and they're thinking about it. But yet they go to the protest and they go home on their phones, which are hard to make in the environment. They drive home in their cars. And we have to just stop and start from the beginning and say, what can we do now that's going to make a change in 100 years? And it's a whole multitude of small changes, lots of little changes. Collectively, we'll get there.
Well, Paul, it's lovely to speak with you. That's Paul O'Brien. He's president of the Federation of Irish Beekeepers. And we will make sure that you can find some information about the National Biodiversity Data Centre All-Ireland Pollinator Plan 2015 to 2020 on our website, which is rte.ie/Mooney. Be kind to the bees, Paul. Isn't that what you're saying?
Absolutely. And if you want to do something for the next 9 weeks over the last of the winter, take up a beekeeping course. You don't have to keep the bees, but take up the course and come to the lectures and you might be fascinated what all the women do in the beehive. As Anna says, it's 97% female and they work themselves to death for the poor lads.
Paul, nothing unusual there. Paul, thank you very much indeed.
You're welcome. Bye-bye, bye-bye.
Now, a hopper of ditches, a cropper of corn, a wee brown cow with two leather horns. This is the animal that we're going to hear about now. It's been present in Ireland for 28,000 years and is our oldest surviving mammal. The males are called Jacks and the females Jills. The animal is the Irish hare. You may remember about 2 years ago, Terry Flanagan spent a day in Dublin Airport with wildlife conservationist Con Farrell and his team, where they rounded up a number of hares, which were then translocated away to new habitats. Earlier this week, Terry headed off to County Wicklow to meet up with Con again to see how successful these translocations have been.
There you go, Terry, look.
Oh, I see him.
Running up across the hedge there now.
Look how light-coloured he is. The one we saw there about 2 minutes ago before that, it was much darker colour. Well, he's gone now, this guy. But I can see that he's really, really fawn-coloured on top, but almost white underneath.
Yeah, well, what happens is it depends on what they're grazing on. If they're grazing on darkish wooded areas, they tend to be more dark. If they're
He's flying up there now, look at him.
If they're out in the open, they tend to be more lighter. But then again, they could be molting now as the getting ready for the breeding season coming, you know. And
because sort of that's where we're into down, now. Yeah. Mad as a March hare.
They're coming on now. And as you say, just hopefully now in the next few minutes, we'll see a lot more coming out to tip and box. And as part of this time of the season, as I say, I look forward to it. And the fresh, frosty mornings, you see them out in the tipping and boxing in tens and twenties. And it's a lovely sight, you know. And it's great to see, like. And
well, just to paint a picture, we're down here in East Wicklow. We're actually on an estate and we're looking out over sea. And just as we're talking, there's a train going by. So we're down near the train line. This is really good land, isn't it?
It's really top-class land for the hare. Absolutely. There's great cover in it. There's wetland, there's grazing, there's crops.
There's every kind of habitat here.
It's a full habitat for the hare. It's an ideal habitat for the hare species and a lot of other species as well, but here it suits the hare down, you know, as I say, down to the ground.
Right.
He loves it. Big open spaces, plenty of places to run, plenty of places to hide and breed, and you know, and they just love it. And plenty of wetland and rushy land, mm-hmm. and then it meets arable
farmland
here, mm-hmm. and they just love it. You know, yeah. It's ideal for them, Terry, and it's great to see it. You know,
and of course, the last time I met you, Con, was in Dublin Airport. And what you were doing is you were catching hares. You were rounding up hares. We went out for the day, a fantastic day out there. And when you catch those hares, you then reintroduce them to other parts of the country. And that's what you've been doing here in County Wicklow.
Yeah.
Now, explain to me, first of all, why are you taking the hares from Dublin Airport?
Well, unfortunately, up in Dublin Airport, there's an abundance of hares up there. It's overrun with hares. One of the reasons, or maybe two of the reasons, is it's fenced in. So anything that's in there is breeding, and there's very little predation that can get in and sort them out. So they don't have any predators, and they're breeding, and as I say, it's a big area, and they just keep breeding, and you know, the numbers are increasing all the time. And what happens is then they become a danger, so they do. Become a danger to the aircraft going up and down, you know, the runways and that. So we were asked about 5 years ago and asked what we could do. I'm involved with hares since I was a young chap, and I said I'd net them up under the Parks and Wildlife auspice, and we reintroduced them onto different farmlands around
because
the country.
You just can't go in and take animals from one area and bring them to another. You have to work through the Parks and Wildlife Service.
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And everything is done to a T, you know, it's under licence. You're monitored, the hares are captured on soft net and long nets, and put into boxes two at a time. Box holds two, plenty of room for breeding. Then they're transported and brought down to farmland within a 2 hours, space of 2 hours of right. being caught and re-released okay. under the guidance of a wildlife ranger.
So I'm just looking at another one going by there, sort of cut across there. That one there is much, much darker. And he's literally legging it all the way down there along that hedgerow.
Yeah, so he's probably just come out of that wood there now. So, and they'll probably lie up in that wood all day long. Winter time, you very seldom see them during the day in the winter time. It's mostly evening, duskish time, night time. Just before dawn, they'll go back in. Summertime, you'll see them out all day. You could see them out all day long. You know, it depends on how quiet the area is. Something like deer, you know, if it's quiet, they'll graze, and if it's not, they'll go in and hide and lie up in the woodland and hedgerows. And as you can see here, Terry, we have 12-metre-long strips of wildflower strips for...
Isn't it?
There's a conservation strips all over the silage fields here. We put them in to help the hares,
right?
You know, and any other species that's here.
Okay, so go back to the airport then. Over the last number of years, because I know you're about 5 years doing this now, how many hares have you taken from Dublin Airport?
Well, in the past 5 years, we've taken a little over 500 hares.
See, no one would believe that. Seems a huge figure.
It's a fierce, like
I know when we go to the airport, we'll see hares there. If you go to the car park, you'll see hares. You might see one or two or maybe half a dozen if you're really lucky. But 500 hares in a couple of years, it's a huge number to take out.
It's a vast number of hares to take out from, we say, I think it's 700 acres up there or more. And, you know, that's a lot of hares.
And you have relocated those hares around the country?
All over the country. Okay. Not just here in East Wicklow, but all over the country. Kildare, Dublin, some parts of Galway, Offaly.
Where we are here now, on this estate here, go back to that 5 years ago. How many hares were on this estate?
There was no hares here. There wasn't one hare here, so there wasn't. And now we reintroduced, over a five-year period, 54 hares in total. That's what have been
released.
And
how are they doing in that 5 years?
And they're absolutely thriving, so they are. It's a vast area, so it is. And not only on this farm, but they've thrived on all the other farms in the locality. And thanks to the landowners, you know, they really appreciate to see them because they said they hadn't seen them from the time they were young.
Yeah, because they're a native species. Yeah. They're an iconic species.
Yeah, they're an iconic species to this country, so they are. And, you know, it's our own Irish hare, and that's it. He's here since the Ice Age, you know, and we have to protect things like that.
And what
into the future.
Numbers now? Are they growing in the sense, are they young? Are there leverets? Do you see them?
Yeah. Oh, there's leverets here. They'll breed maybe 3-4 times a year. Three leverets average a time, and we come across them all the time, so we do here.
What about predators?
Well, we're trying to control the predators here, so we do, and give them a good chance. You know, that's the that was part
be?
Of it. There was no part, you know. Well, the grey crow, the hooded crow, as we know, would be a big predator.
Yeah.
So you would the
that would be of young leverets.
Young leverets and the fox, or mink.
Buzzards.
The mink and the buzzard.
I saw a buzzard when I was coming down today, literally sitting on the tree, not 20 feet away from me. So I thought, this guy looks quite tame.
Yeah. Well, he's tame, all right, but he's probably watching a leveret somewhere now.
Well, we now moved, you know, into springtime. And the old saying, mad as a March hare, are you seeing it here at the moment?
It's starting now. It's starting in the last couple of weeks. It's starting to gather up and the boxing's going to go on. So it is.
Explain it to us.
The boxing, what happens is the females start coming into season there. As I say, they come in a couple of times a year now, but you see, hares are solitary. You'll see one hare in one paddock, another hare in another
what
paddock.
What we've seen today, they're all individuals.
They're individuals, and then as soon as the female comes into season, the males start gathering, so they do, and then they're sniffing around, and as like we did when we were young lads, and all of a sudden the boxing starts, and the fittest and the best hair will get the females, and actually right. could have five or six females in a few minutes, and I've often seen it there, and I'd walk up beside them and they wouldn't even take any notes. They just hop away. So
they've only one thing on their mind.
One thing on their mind. Valentine's Day, I'd like to say. It's one thing, is just constantly. And
how many would you have seen together? Because, as you said,
the most I've seen
animals.
Here, yes. The most I've seen here on a morning was 22 hares gathered in a circle.
Wow. Yeah.
And it was a spectacular sight. A couple of times I've seen 11, 12, 15, but 22. Was the most I've seen here one morning.
And that would be this time of the year.
This time of the year. Come just end of February, early into March, you know, a lovely time of the year.
Yeah.
The frost is nearly gone and, you know, everything's starting to grow, new life, as I say, and it's great to see it. And the animals know when it's time to pack up and get ready to breed, you know, they all gather and the hares are no different.
Yeah. Do they do any harm here on the farm? Because I've read and I've heard about them, say, at trees, biting away at the bark of trees.
It's like any animal, you know, they have to feed, so they do. Now, as we say, we have all woodland around us here, Terry, you can see it.
Yeah.
And
we have it well fenced,
you know, it's well fenced off. And there's a farm just down the road from here, there's 40 acres of young trees, and there was hares introduced there, and because it was well fenced off, there's no problem with it.
Yeah.
There's no problem with it. But, you know, if it's done right, there is absolutely no problem. Hmm. And that, you know, and that's the key to anything, so it is. And like that, the farmers, without them, we'd be lost. You know, they love wildlife, so they do, and they just need to be encouraged. And, you know, when I ask them, can I reintroduce hares, they say, okay, but what's the problems they'll bring? They don't bring much problems, only we might get a few poachers after them, you know. And we have the parks of wildlife. Well, we have to, look, the hare is a protected species.
Mm-hmm.
And all over the country, they're being hammered by poachers. And we have the National Parks and Wildlife Service and the Angarda Síochána. And they give us great help. But unfortunately, Times predicted there about 10 years ago that they had to cut back on parks and wildlife funding.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no overtime, as we say, for them. So when it comes 4 o'clock,
they knock off,
and it's hard at night time, you know. So it's left to the likes of me and other guys, mostly lads that are involved with the coursing clubs, you know, only for them, like that they're out protecting hares at night time. And
how are you doing? How successful are you at protecting them?
Well, we are, and there's a lot of prosecutions gone on this year.
Good.
You know,
yeah.
and there's one guard very strong, and he's a damn that these lads are being brought to book, which should be. They're committing a wildlife crime, you know, against a species that belongs to this island. And we're successful. It's dangerous out there. A couple of farmers have been abused, and a couple of them have been subject to injuries over it, you know. And it's a serious problem, and people don't realise it. And only for the likes of lads that are involved with clubs and things like that, you know, farms and that, gamekeepers and that, only for that, you know, we'd be in serious trouble, you know.
Well, you know, society, the population of Ireland, everybody that's living here, we owe you a debt for doing that, for looking after this wildlife, for going out at times and maybe putting your own lives at risk, just so that we can drive by or come onto a farm and see these beautiful animals, because they are a beautiful, and as I said, they are an iconic species.
Absolutely, yeah. Like, we'll keep doing it as long as we can. As long as God is willing, I'll keep doing it anyway, because I grew up with them, I live with them, and hopefully I'll die with them. And that'll be my, I'll have a smile on my face. As I always say to my mother at home, if you find me dead in the field, you know, I died happy. And that's the way it'll be, you know. And hopefully long may it continue, you know, that people and farmers, the goodwill of the farmers will keep going. And maybe we can get people of society in the big cities to realise that there is people out there doing good for the hare. They're not just out to kill them or anything like that, you know. And hopefully there's another hare running up across the field there now. Look, there's a beaut now.
Come on, we get in the Jeep, so, and we're going to try it. No, we'll follow him and see.
We'll see
how many more we can
see. We can see. We can go spotting a few hares.
Right, come on, let's go.
Thank you very much indeed, Terry. More details on the website rte.ie/Mooney. Now listen to this sound. That's the rising and falling continuous churring of the nightjar. Nightjars are one of the most enigmatic species, and they're rarely seen due to their nocturnal habits. They're also known as the goat sucker, as it was believed that it sucked the milk of cows and goats. It was once so widely known in Ireland that people gave it the name, Aina?
Turning Lean, because it sounded just like a spinning wheel, and Turning Lean is a spinning wheel.
A spinning wheel. However, numbers completing the journey to Ireland from African wintering grounds each summer have fallen dramatically in recent decades. This is thought to be related to habitat loss and a decrease in large insects due to the use of pesticides. However, John Lusby, Conservation Officer at Birdwatch Ireland, is here to tell us that its forgotten and fabled call was heard again recently. John, you're very welcome to the programme. Tell us all about the nightjar. Where was it heard? Was it you or somebody else who heard it?
So I must credit, it was a friend and colleague of mine, Alan Mee, who you know well, who's been on the show many times.
Yes, Dr.
And
Alan Mee.
Yeah, that's right, indeed, that spearheaded the Whitetail Eagle Reintroduction Project, but obviously changed his focus last summer. So we carried out a survey, actually, in the south of the country, two upland areas, the Galtees and the Knockmeal Downs, and we had quite an extensive survey there because that was actually the last place that nightjars have been recorded in Ireland. But we unfortunately didn't find any nightjars there, but Alan carried out some additional survey work in the Ballyhoras, which is an upland area just on the Cork-Limerick border, and had that recorded that magical churring sound that you just hear there, which is the first time it has been heard in suitable breeding habitat for quite a few years. So a really, really important discovery, and great to know that that nightjars are still out there.
And is that a mating call, the same as the corncrake sound, just emitted by the males looking for women in territory?
Exactly. That's the churring call, is the male typically sitting up on a bare branch or a tree and broadcasting himself, you know, out over suitable habitat, trying to attract a female. And amazing call to listen to. It really, obviously, you know, in the night sky, there's some, you know, really unusual sounds that we hear from breeding birds and also mammals. But this one in particular is really magical.
And is it migratory?
It is, yeah. So they arrive to Ireland typically in May, and then quite a short stint that they spend in Ireland. Then they obviously breed here, the ones that do stay here, and then they leave again in September, and they return to their African wintering grounds. So it's only quite a short spell that they actually spend in Ireland, and obviously much fewer now would migrate from Africa to Ireland than we once had back a few decades ago.
John, the nightjar has been declining in many European countries right back into the 19th century. But an interesting observation, in 68 to 72, they were at an all-time low, but there was a bit of a recovery in Britain. The numbers actually increased substantially, relatively speaking. Do you think there's the hope that will spread here?
Very possibly, and I think that was one of the reasons that we wanted to carry out the survey the summer just gone, was just because of that. And I think with nightjars, they're definitely a bird that can go under the radar, and they're a bird that people aren't really accustomed or used to hearing, but they're also one that, you know, they're quite cryptic. During the day, they essentially just disappear. They blend into their background. They'll be tucked away either on the ground or, you know, camouflaged against the branch or the trunk of a tree. So it's only for a short period at dusk and then at dawn that they actually, you know, make their presence known, and that they emit that wonderful magical churring call. But it's also they only inhabit quite remote areas, so they are a bird that, unless we're actually actively going out and searching for them, they're very likely to be under-recorded. So obviously the last summer we did record that nightjar are still present in Ireland, but even prior to that there was the general consensus was that they could actually completely disappeared from Ireland and that they no longer bred here. So we did find them in the Ballyhoras last summer, but we don't know what other areas they occur and how widespread they might be. So it is a really interesting one. And just as you said, Richard, the population in the UK has been doing quite well over the last few years. So there's nothing to say that population increase in the UK might influence, you know, an increase in numbers here in Ireland.
Are they ground nesting birds, or are they in trees?
No, they're ground nesting, and they've got really cryptic kind of mottled plumage that really camouflages them to the ground. So they typically nest on the ground in leaf litter, and the main nesting habitat now in Ireland would be in young forest plantations. So essentially non-native conifer plantation that either would be clear felled and then the young forest is growing up again, or young plantations. So they would nest on the ground in young plantation like that.
John, we're used to things being controlled by the sun and daylight, but there is a hint that the nightjar's fortunes are to some extent controlled by moonlight. There was a paper back in the late 90s by Chris Perrins and Christopher Crick, which argued that the nightjar likes to lay on a rising moon. As the moon is getting brighter steadily, that is when they will lay. They're interested in timing the hatching, the young being the maximum food demand and fledging, for when the moon is full. The reason for that, of course, is that they contemplate a second nest. But if the moon is rising too late in the season, they lose out on the second nest. This was the argument of the paper. And so in a year in which there's late rising moon, the nightjar won't do so well. Are there nightjar years?
Well, to answer that, we just don't know, because we know so little about them in the Irish in the Irish context. But that's a really interesting point that you raised. And it obviously, from an ecological perspective, from the nightjar's perspective, it makes a lot of sense. With all birds, they want to coincide their breeding with when food is most abundant and available, when they're feeding their young. And the behaviour of nightjar, they are obviously nocturnal birds, but they're, you know, to look at them, they're quite an unusual looking bird. But when you see them in action, you can see that they're highly adapted for their purpose, and they've got very, very large eyes and very large gaping mouth, and that is essentially to catch flying insects, moths and the likes on the wing. And their main hunting method would be by sitting on a branch and then silhouetting their prey against the night sky. So you can imagine, you know, in better light conditions, that makes their hunting even easier, and they want that to coincide with when they have to feed hungry mouths in the nest.
So they're competing with bats then, in that sense, because they're feeding on flying insects rather than, say, other night birds like owls that feed on mammals on the ground. So as a consequence then, with the reduction in insects due to all of this insecticide business, this is having an impact on their food, probably, apart from the moonlight at all.
Yeah, absolutely. And with the Paul was just on talking about bees, like it's an area that affects, you know, biodiversity across the board in terms of the decline of insects. And with nightjars that would specialise on flying insects at night, you can imagine with a reduction in insect numbers that's obviously going to have a consequence, as it does with many other wildlife, that, you know, insects are a core part of the food chain. So that is one of the threats that has likely brought about a reduction in numbers in nightjar. Also as well, with the changing landscape, and it's interesting because with a lot of birds we would talk about the negative effects of increasing forest cover, of non-native forest cover. I better specify that. But with nightjar and with that, you know, we've talked about the likes of hen harrier and merlin and the negative effects of non-native forest. But with nightjar, it's potentially one that may have benefited, because that's their main nesting habitat, and that's probably linked to their increase in the UK. And it was interesting when we were carrying out the survey last summer in the Galtees and Knockmill Downs, there seems to be a lot of suitable habitat, so kind of, you know, forest cover in the low-lying hills for nightjar. So it would be really interesting to know, you know, just do they occur in other areas, and are they actually on the increase? Obviously we only recorded them in the Ballyhoras, but we just don't know where else they might occur and in what numbers.
So we need citizen scientists then to actually, because I mean, once you hear them, you can't really mix them up with something else. So if you do hear something like a spinning wheel churring along at night in an area where there might be some woodland nearby, all you have to do is all these inevitable mobile phones, we take it out and record the thing, and it's a record.
Absolutely, and as you say, it's an unmistakable call. Once you've heard it once, you know you know what it is, and it is a really good one for citizen science, like the other species you mentioned, like long-eared owl, and that would call it night. And because there's so few out there, that any records of nightjar would be absolutely valuable.
Is this goatsucker name, is this just an Irish thing, a name in Ireland, or is this a name given across Europe? The idea that these birds, because they're such big mouths and they're out at night, are probably stealing the milk, like the way hares, I suppose, steal the milk as well, aren't they? From animals, from cows and goats. Or is that an Irish nickname, or is it a European one?
No, it's not just Irish, so it seems to be very widespread, and it's one of the more bizarre ones. I think with a lot of night flying birds, there a lot of them are suspected of witchery, and I think because, you know, nocturnal birds, a lot of them have quite, you know, strange eerie calls. They're obviously difficult to see, so there's a lot of superstition kind of surrounding them. But definitely with nightjar, it's one of the more bizarre ones, and they have been labelled with the name of goat suckers, and I think it's partly due to their strange appearance. They've got a very, very large mouth, but very, very small actual bill, beak, and as well
like
as
a
that,
swift, nearly.
Exactly, and they're actually they kind of fit in classification terms. They fit in between swifts and owls, and they would bear some resemblance to both, but also very unique in their own right in terms of their appearance and behaviour.
Because the Irish word tourneen actually refers to a spinning wheel rather than anything to do with drinking milk out of goats.
Yeah, exactly, and the spinning wheel sound, obviously, you know, linked to their kind of rhythmic hypnotic call.
John, do they hate being on the ground? Anna mentioned swifts there. Well, now, swifts don't like to come to ground. They are forced to do so to lay their eggs and so forth. Now, this nightjar in the autumn will head off and southwards, cross the Mediterranean, cross the Sahara, the Sahel, an enormous journey. But being an insect eater and insects on the wing eater, then this is nothing to it, or should be nothing to it. If it moves from oasis to oasis, it'll get plenty of insects to eat over the water and that sort of thing. So it's not worried about getting exhausted or starving along the way. But it probably needs places to come down and rest, because it's not going to stay flying around during the day. And when it gets to Africa, it's got to come down again. The model for swift is close, but indeed the swift is a distant relative, but still it's different, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Just as you described the swift, they're not well adapted at all for perching, for landing on the ground, and very, very small feet. So they actually have difficulty taking off again if they do find themselves on the ground. Whereas nightjar, it wouldn't be the case, and they would spend a lot of the time on the ground, and during the day, mostly they would be, you know, camouflaged on the ground, say, you know, among leaf litter on the ground, and they can incredibly good camouflage. They virtually disappear into the background. But they also, in terms of their flight, then it's amazing to watch them. They are incredibly agile flyers. They've got a very kind of erratic, buoyant flight when you see them at dusk, and that's, you know, they're changing their trajectory and course as they spot insects on the wing and to catch them in the air. But they are quite strong flyers. So in terms of the migration, they would be well equipped for that, definitely.
Have you ever seen one?
I have, just the glimpses would be, and unfortunately I've not seen them in Ireland, so that's still on my to-do list. So I've seen them in other countries, actually the Netherlands and also in Finland, but the views kind of, because they only become active as the sun is setting, you know, the views are typically limited to a fairly short period during the night when you see them silhouette as they're flying around their territory. And they've also got an amazing display, kind of similar to some of our other nocturnal species, because obviously when they're advertising themselves, it's going to be dark, so they have, you know, other audio cues that they make to advertise themselves and their territory. And they've got an amazing wing clapping as well, like some of our other species do, like long-eared owl, where they actually clap their wings above their back and can make quite a loud sound. So that, in addition to the chirring for a short period during the dusk, is unmistakable and absolutely magical to hear.
Well, I'd love to hear them as part of the Dawn Chorus this year.
Well, absolutely.
May and June. Would there be Dawn Chorus beginning in May? Would there be here the beginning of May, do you reckon, John?
Yeah, they would. It's kind of from mid-May onwards, really, that they start to arrive, and that then they start to call.
Well, we could be lucky. It's the first week. It's the bank holiday weekend in May this year for the Dawn Chorus, the fifth international Dawn Chorus, and 25 years, as Aina reminded me the other day, of Mooney Goes Wild in May. Can you believe it? 25 years on the air, we're all aging. John, it's great news anyway, so thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, Derek. Thanks, Aina and Richard.
Good luck, John.
Bye-bye.
That's pretty much all we have time for today. My thanks to Aina Nilana and Richard Collins, to Jarlath Holland, our broadcast coordinator, our researcher is John Riley. On sound, we had Tommy O'Sullivan, and our producer is Anna Letty. Until next week, goodbye.
And Mooney Goes Wild was presented by Derek Mooney.